Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here with Pastor William Fink, and we're on our continuing study here of the writings of Paul and Yahweh's covenant people since its inception. So now over a year ago, we have been studying the epistles of Paul and demonstrating that Paul is by no means an antinomian. Paul is by no means a universalist, and that all of the criticisms of Paul, we have basically, you know, the Paul bashers within identity, and outside of identity, we have the Judeo-Christian idolizers of Paul who take a lot of his writings out of context and turn it into a new religion, okay? And because these antinomians and universalists have done that with the verses of Paul, that then the Paul bashers within identity say, okay, well, that must be the real Paul, rather than really investigating the language, you know, and doing word studies and investigating the context. They simply accept what the Paul idolizers have done and say, well, that's horrible, you know, and it is horrible, but it's not Paul's fault. You can't blame Paul for how his work has been translated. But so today I want to start the show. This is from the Covenant Answering Service. And the Covenant Messenger was an outstanding magazine published by W.G. Fenley of the Federation of the Covenant People. And the last address was P.O. Box 830, Honeydew, South Africa. Don't try to write to that because it no longer exists. But the answering service has this question, which W.G. Fenley provides the answer to. Here's the question. The subject of the Gentiles has always intrigued both my wife and myself. We have noted in the shorter Oxford English Dictionary that the word Gentile is a Middle English, circa 1150 to 1450 A.D., a word adapted from the Latin Gentiles, from gent or gens, meaning nation. We find it difficult to reconcile today's usage of the word. Could you elaborate? Okay, so today's usage of the word, the Jews have trained us to define Gentile as meaning non-Jew. Okay? But that's not the definition that Paul or any other Hebrew or Greek author of the Bible, none of those had that definition in mind, and it's a false definition. Anyway, here is W.G. Finlay's answer. If one considers the vocabulary used by today's generation, one sees that the older generation are called squares, implying that they are not with it. Okay, this goes back to the 60s, no doubt. Whatever it may be. Until recently, one finds that the word square is applied in social sense, and it meant just, equitable, honest, honorable, straightforward, precise, steady, and reliable, okay? But in the 60s and 70s, the word square began to mean silly and old-fashioned, etc., okay? Future generations will therefore find it difficult to understand how the word square could be given a range of meaning so diametrically opposed to the dictionary definition. One has precisely the same problem with the word Gentile as indeed with many other words recorded in the scriptures. In considering the Latin dictionary, the question rightly states that the English Gentile originates from the Latin language. One finds the following definition, gens, gentis, root, gen, gigno, that which belongs together by birth or descent. That's not the definition we're used to, right? A race or clan embracing several families united together by a common name, originally only patrician, but after the granting of the connubium between patrician and plebeians, also plebeians. The word gentilis is defined as, quote, of or belonging to the same clan, stock, or race. A person belonging to the same family or gens, a relative bearing the same name. So far, folks, we see that the word Gentile should mean kinsman. Okay, continuing here. The Greek word embodying the same meaning is ethnos, while in Hebrew the equivalent word is goy. At some stage in history, the three words goy, ethnos, and gentilis were given secondary meanings, which, with the passage of time, excluded the primary meaning completely. The source of this change may be historically traced to the Jews. Okay, he's got it all right so far.
Absolutely.
When Israel was in the land i.e. before the captivities, they were entirely indifferent to their neighbors and had no particular name for those who had a faith different from their own. The surrounding nations were simply called Galil HaGoyim, which literally translated meant circle of the nations, which carried no stigma castigating their belief. They were simply the people outside of Israel. That's all it meant, okay? Thus, Israel looked on the neighboring nations simply in the list in light of geography and nothing else. One more paragraph here. However, after the Judean nation had established it, not the Judean nation, okay, not Judahite, the Judean, he's talking about the mixture between the Judahites and the Idumeans under John Hyrcanus. This is what he's talking about. The Judean nation had established itself, bearing in mind that it was a nation only in the political and not the racial sense. He's got this perfect. They introduced a secondary meaning for the Hebrew goy, in that anyone who practiced a faith different to theirs was labeled with the secondary meaning and implied a heathen. Thus, to the Jewish mind and in the Jewish vocabulary, the Hebrew word goy, irrespective of its primary meaning of nation, became synonymous with everyone who did not belong to their faith. Okay? So this is how the word Gentile came to mean the opposite of what it really means. Later, when the scriptures were translated into Latin, Jewish thought still prevailed, and the Ecclesiastics took the Latin gens and gave it a secondary meaning which has survived to the present day in the word Gentile. Individuals, groups, and nations who are not of the Jewish faith are therefore called Gentiles, thus perpetuating the Jewish practice of coining secondary meanings which are advantageous to their masquerade. Wow. Can anybody put it any better than that?
So, no, that was excellent, and I can't really offer better definitions of gentilis than he did.
Yeah.
It definitely means a people of the same race.
That's right.
When Jerome translated the Vulgate, he had three ways to translate the Greek word ethnos.
Okay.
Okay? There's three words in Latin that can be used to describe nations or peoples.
Okay.
The three words are gentilis, natio, which comes from the word natus, meaning birth.
Okay.
And natio means a nation.
Uh-huh.
And that's the word we get nativity and nation from.
Okay.
And similar words. And a natio, in the plural, would infer people of different nations and races.
Yes.
When it's used in the plural.
Okay.
And the third word would be populi, which is the word that we get people from.
Right.
And population and words like that.
Yes.
And that would mean a populace was a people as a political unit.
Okay.
In Latin.
Okay.
Very similar to the way we use the word nation.
Okay. Yes.
And it would have intoned in the plural people of different races and different nations.
Okay.
But Jerome chose gentilis.
Okay.
And that, to me, indicates that he understood that there was one single race that the covenants belonged to.
Right, because that's what the word gentilis actually means.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And if you're at, Jerome, I don't know the Vulgate, but I know that he translated ethnos in the New Testament into gentilis.
Okay.
And
yes,
there had to be a reason why, out of those three words,
mm-hmm,
of those three words, he chose gentilis.
Yes.
Because
yes,
it definitely indicates an innate relationship.
Right.
In those various nations.
Yes. Yeah. So this answer that W.G. Finlay gave to that question is actually, it's superb. It's absolutely superb. It explains the historicity of the fact of how the meaning of a word can change over time, and in this case, the exact opposite of the original meaning is what people understand it to mean today. And he said, this is the Jews doing.
Right, but Abraham was told that many goy would come from your loins.
Right.
Many goyim would come from your loins.
And it's not non-Israelite goyim.
Absolutely. And that's why Acts 9:13.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Acts 9:15. And Acts 9:15 says that
because that's where it says, where he is a chosen vessel to me to bear my name before the nations, which it should really say they're not Gentiles. But if you understand what the word Gentile really means,
Well, it's the nations and the kings of the sons of Israel.
Yes, it's talking about Israelites, plain and simple.
And both those nations and those kings, in the Greek, it's unmistakable that both those nations and those kings
yes.
belong to the sons of Israel.
Yes, absolutely.
There's no getting around that in the
yeah.
Greek.
So anybody listening, for, you know, when you read the Bible and you see that word Gentiles in there, know that it has been redefined, falsely redefined by the Jews for their purposes to imply that we Christians should embrace non-Israelites as Christians. That's why it's there, for that deceptive purpose. Right? Isn't that the case, Bill?
Well, absolutely. And like I like to say, when a Jew moves his lips, he's lying.
Yeah.
We cannot accept
yeah.
Jewish definitions of words.
And we can't.
Look at how the Jew has perverted the English language
yeah.
for the last 50 years.
Right.
And who wouldn't think that he would do that
yeah.
to Hebrew 2,000 years ago?
Exactly.
Or to Greek 1900, 1800
yes.
years. Of course he did it.
Yes. Yeah, and he invented the word Judeo-Christian, didn't he?
The Jew is the perverter of all things.
That's right. That's right. Now, given that understanding and W.G. Finlay's understanding of who did this and why does he blame Paul? And
I have no idea why he blames Paul.
And accept Jewish critics of him?
And he blames Paul that subsequent people didn't understand Greek?
Right.
I don't get that at all.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, so he must have taken a stupid pill or something.
Exactly. Well, he realizes what ethnos means.
Right.
Or ethnoi, ethnoi is the
yeah.
nominative plural.
Yeah.
He realizes what ethnoi means. And to realize what ethnoi means,
mm-hmm.
you have to go evaluate how Paul used the word.
That's right.
And
absolutely.
Paul was going to, I mean, Romans chapter 4, Paul defines the covenant as belonging to the nations of Abraham,
uh-huh.
and Paul defines the faith of Abraham as being the belief that many nations would come from his loins.
Right. Certainly.
And Paul in Romans chapter 9 says that those nations are from Israel.
Yes.
So who did Paul go to?
Yes.
The nations that came from Abraham's loins? Through Jacob?
Yeah.
Could that be a possibility?
Well, that couldn't possibly mean that, Bill.
And when we look at
all
the
Israelites.
When we look at all of Paul's letters and what he tells the various people, we can see in history
yes.
that's exactly who he went to.
That's right. That's right. So once you understand the true meaning of the word Gentile, that it means people of the same race, then this false definition becomes exposed.
And we have to remember, and this is a concept that people have to wrap their minds around,
yes.
is that to the Greeks, the word race was a subdivision of the word nation.
Okay. All right.
Okay?
For them.
And
okay.
in the Old Testament, the race of Jacob was a subdivision of the Hebrew people.
Okay, right. And it was. Yeah.
But the Christian revelation is that one race would become many nations.
Okay.
Therefore, today,
yes.
we see the word race as not a subdivision of nation, but we see the word nation as a subdivision of race.
Yeah, we have the perspective. But basically, we're still talking about the same race of people, the same subdivisions of that race. That's what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
That's who the Bible is about.
Right, and technically we are still only a subdivision of the Adamic race.
Right, exactly.
But we've you know, the Saxons have become many people, many nations.
Yes, and married into other, and it's perfectly okay for us to marry into the other nations of Genesis 10, which were all the white nations, all the white descendants of the family of Noah.
Right, but I wouldn't recommend that anybody marry a Persian or a Mede today.
Well, not today, no.
Or an
yeah, right.
Assyrian. No.
Right, yeah. And even though Ahmadinejad may have some Judahite blood, a lot of people misunderstand when you know, the Jews say, you know, there's all this rumor going out about Ahmadinejad that he has Jewish blood. Well, you know, I think he would put it this way, that if he has Judahite blood, he'd be proud of it, okay? But people routinely mistake Judah and Jew. The same way as people mistake Gentile for non-Israelites.
Right. Well, those people that were left behind in Babylon, they were the bad figs. And if they weren't all bad figs, they sure as hell became all bad figs.
So
the Mongols and the Arabs went through that land.
Right. So he may indeed have some Judahite blood, but it's the bad fig blood. Right.
Right, but look at it. He's apparently a Mamzer. It's readily evident.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it. So, but you see, what they use the word Jew to imply that it meant the Judahites of the Old Testament and all these mongrels who call themselves Jews today. Well, folks, they're two totally different groups of people. They can't be compared. They're not the same people. Okay?
Absolutely not.
But yet, Christians are brainwashed into believing that they are. So these words, Jew, Gentile, must be totally understood in their historical context. And if you don't understand the historical context, you will simply be confused. And that's why, Bill, people reject Christianity because it's so confusing. It doesn't make sense to them. You know, that the Bible says that the Israel would be a blessing, and they look at the Jews, Jews today, and all of war and mayhem that they're causing, well, this is a blessing? I don't get it.
Basically, the Greek and the Latin languages were, I don't have a real good adjective for it. They were Catholicized.
Yes.
They were universalized.
Right. There you go.
It's actually, Catholicized actually doesn't do any service to the Greek word Catholos.
Okay.
From whence it comes.
Okay.
But they were perverted in the Middle Ages through the minds of
right.
Well, I'm going to call them simple-minded clerics.
Right.
And you know, they, most of them were probably men without guile.
Yes.
But that simply didn't know anything about history or the ancient world,
and
had no
Christians
real idea what they
today.
Were talking about.
Right. Yes. They have Judeo-Christians today have absolutely no historical perspective of the Bible, and they spiritualized and universalized everything.
And
that's
the same was true in the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth centuries.
Yes. Right. Exactly. Okay. So so let's go back into the Book of Acts. So we just briefly touched on Acts 9:15. About how the Gentiles in Acts 9:15 are actually Israelites, and they're not non-Israelites. And, of course, we have to appreciate the context of any given passage. It could, the word nation, or in the Greek it's ethnos, the Greek ethnos could be referring to Israelite nations, non-Israelite nations, or both.
We
have to look at the context. It's the context that determines that. It never, never, never means non-Jews.
Right. Often in the Old Testament, it refers to the other Genesis 10 Adamic nations.
Right, exactly.
And that's also true in various places in the New Testament.
Right. And so they were, again, kinsmen of the Israelites. Okay? So this type of confusion, the Bible is rife with this kind of confusion. We need to understand this. Okay, here we go. Acts chapter 9, verse 17. And Ananias went his way and entered into the house, and putting his hands on him, said, Brother Saul, the Lord, even Jesus that appeared to you in the way as you came, has sent me that you might receive your sight and be filled with the Holy Ghost. And immediately there fell from his eyes as it had been scales, and he received sight forthwith and arose and was baptized. Now, you think you have an insight on this word scales? That,
well, right. I think that Paul may have been blinded from the radiant light that he saw on the road to Damascus.
Okay.
And the radiation actually seared the outsides of his corneas.
Okay.
That's what I believe, and this is why I believe it.
Very
well,
possible.
Well, first,
or his eyelids, yes. Or his eyebrows.
It's pretty clear that something like scales fell from his eyes.
Okay. Okay.
All right.
Scabs. Yes.
Well, right. But this is his eyes, and
yes,
he's blind, and that wouldn't, it couldn't be just the eye socket.
Yes.
It had to be the eye itself.
Okay.
But I'm gonna quote something from the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Okay.
Now, this is from the Book of Tobit, but this is different in the Septuagint version of Tobit. Doesn't read anything like this at the appropriate section.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
And I'm sorry, I don't have the actual, you know, where this would be in the Septuagint.
Okay.
But it's the Dead Sea Scroll known as 4Q Tobit B, which is the designation 4Q197. That's the fragment number, and every book of the Dead Sea Scrolls contains that.
Okay.
That numbering system.
All right.
And it's fragment 4, column 1, and it says that As for the gall, it is to anoint the eyes of a man. And they're talking about the gall of a certain fish here.
Okay.
Okay, for curing certain maladies.
Okay.
It is to anoint the eyes of a man on whom burns had been caused.
Uh-huh.
The
okay.
scales shall fall away from him, and they shall be cured.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So this is talking about the gall or the bile of a certain fish being, and the eyes of someone who was burned would be anointed by this bile, and they would be cured.
Uh-huh.
So that shows culturally what happened to Paul's eyes.
Okay.
What this is saying.
Yes. Okay, so either it's a figurative statement or it could be very literal. Perhaps someone had anointed his eyes with this gall or this, you know, remedy, whatever, and it just could be literal or figurative or even both. Okay?
Right, but it is actually both.
Okay.
Okay, because Paul's eyes were opened on the road to Damascus.
Yes.
Just
yes.
not the eyes in his head.
Yes. Okay.
But the it's clearly to be taken literally here.
Right. Okay, very good. All right, verse 19. And when he had received meat, he was strengthened. Then was Saul certain days with the disciples which were at Damascus. Okay. And verse 20. And immediately he preached Christ in the synagogues that he is the Son of God. Now, of course, we've found in previous chapters that it's probably in these same synagogues that where Stephen was stoned to death by some of these people.
Right, and where Paul was persecuting the people.
Right.
And I'd like to say something about Paul's conversion.
Okay.
Because a lot of people, even in Identity, teach that Paul went to the Arabian desert for 3 years.
Okay.
And that's just not true.
Okay.
You know, Paul, and I think it's actually Swift or Comparator, they follow in that, but I really forget.
Right.
The truth is that Paul went to Arabia after the episode with Hananias, but then he returned to Damascus, where he remained for 3 years.
Okay.
He did not stay 3 years in the Arabian desert,
okay.
as a lot of people like to teach.
So he made a quick side trip.
Well, right. And what Galatians, I think it's 3:17 or 4:17, it says, nor had I gone up to Jerusalem to those who were ambassadors before me, rather I departed into Arabia and then again returned to Damascus.
Okay.
Then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So he spent the 3 years in Damascus.
Yeah, and Damascus is north of Jerusalem, a couple hundred miles or so.
Well, right. It's at least 100 miles, I think.
Yeah, right.
But here we're going to see that, you know, Paul spent 3 years in Damascus, and it just gets a couple of lines here in Acts.
Right.
In chapter 9 of Acts.
Okay. Okay. All right, so we're getting this history down, and he did not spend 3 years in Arabia. It was 3 years at Damascus. Okay, so verse 21, but all that heard him were amazed and said, is not this he that destroyed them which called on this name in Jerusalem and came here for that intent that he might bring them bound to the chief priests? Okay, so people are acknowledging the fact, hey, Paul was part of the people that were persecuting the Christians. Yes, he was. Verse 22, but Saul increased the more in strength and confounded the Jews which dwelt at Damascus, proving that this is very Christ. So here, I think we should take the word Jews to mean Judeans, who are primarily Judahites.
Right. They're absolutely Judahites. And
yes.
It's probably a mixed audience to some extent.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, there's probably some Edomites among them.
Yeah.
There always are.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't get any group of white people in America and expect not to have a Jew.
Well, there's the Jews for Jesus. they're always sitting in the back of the room. And the Messianic Jews who claim that, well, you know, we don't really accept the first time Jesus came. But the next time he comes, we'll accept. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay, verse 23. And after that, many days were fulfilled. And the Judeans took counsel to kill him. Okay, so I think the proper translation here is Judean, okay?
Right, but they're rejecting the gospel here.
That's right, absolutely. Verse 24, but their laying await was known of Saul, and they watched the gates day and night to kill him. Okay, so first of all, I would like to say in Paul's defense here that if his conversion is not valid, or sincere, Why would he subject himself to, being, killed by these people?
Right. The account makes no sense at all.
Yeah, it wouldn't.
Unless his conversion's sincere.
Yeah.
It absolutely makes sense.
If he were a phony, it would say, well, but Paul or Saul conspired with the Jews,
right, and persecuted him right from the beginning.
A Christian. Yeah.
They persecute him right from the beginning. They persecute him. It's
right.
All over the book of Acts.
As soon as he made his conversion, right. The
and
Jews,
it's not written to fool people.
Right.
It's a very plain, simple account.
Right. And, so if you start questioning blatantly simple statements like this in the Bible, then, then you're opening the floodgates to questioning every statement in the Bible,
Well, right. Well, the Paul bashers have already eliminated Paul, Luke, Acts, and 2 Peter from their gospel.
Right, right.
From the New Testament.
And as we were discussing last night about the tremendous number of prophecies that have been fulfilled, scripturally fulfilled, that the page after page, prophecy after prophecy, the Bible has these predictions that come true. And Paul uttered several of these himself.
And in Luke and in Paul.
Yes.
And in Acts.
And so, this is more proof than suspicions about Paul's intentions, okay? The fact that all these prophecies have come through, and this history that we're discussing now is verifiable history, okay? All right, verse 25. Then the disciples...
I'm sorry. Read 25. I'm getting ahead of myself.
Then the disciples took him by night and led him down by the wall in the basket, okay? And when Saul was come to Jerusalem, he essayed to join himself to the disciples, but they were all afraid of him and believed not that he was a disciple. Now, of course, up to this point, we can suspect Paul because, he was a turncoat. He switched sides.
Right, and they would despise him for it.
Right.
He would be like a Benedict Arnold to them.
That's right.
Fighting on the side of the American patriots against the king, the oppressive king, and then switching sides.
Right, yeah. And how can we trust this guy? And so their suspicions of him are absolutely accurate. Legitimate. Verse 27.
Now let me say first that this lowering him down by the wall in a basket.
Okay.
That's actually, it may be, it says by the wall in my translation, but it actually may be through the wall. Many of the cities of the ancient world actually had houses built into the city walls.
Okay, yes.
Or the city walls were built into the building, whichever way you want to look at it.
Yes.
And
yes.
A lot of those buildings would have openings to the city outside of the wall.
Okay.
To the outside of the city.
Right, right.
And they those openings were used, they were often used for criminal purposes,
right.
but they were also often used to defend the city.
Yes, yes, okay. Yeah, and so, and then as these walled cities grew, people attached their houses to the walls, and the cities spread around the walls. That's how things were done in those days, yes.
Right, but you could walk into the front of the house and go to the back of the house and actually climb the wall.
And then go into the...
climb through a window and be outside of the city.
Yes. Okay.
And I've seen actual pictures of those buildings like that in archaeology.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I bet the Rothschilds had a wall that they could sneak out of the ghetto at night too.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Right. Okay. Verse 27. But Barnabas took him and brought him to the apostles and declared to them how he had seen the Lord in the way, and that he had spoken to him and how he had preached boldly at Damascus in the name of Jesus, which is a courageous thing to do. It's like if you or I went to Washington, D.C. and proclaimed that the Zionists need to be kicked out of Washington, okay, that would be a courageous thing to do. That's the type of thing that Paul did here, right?
Verse
28. And he was with them coming in and going out at Jerusalem. So he started hanging out with these people. And he spoke boldly in the name of the Lord Jesus and disputed against the Grecians. But they went about to slay him. So he's making enemies of the Judahites, the Edomites, and the Greeks. He's endearing himself to everybody, isn't
he? Right. Well, let me say, the Grecians are actually the Hellenists.
Yes.
Okay? They're not Greeks. They're Hebrews that are, with Greek customs and dress and things like that.
Okay.
They're Philo Greeks.
Yes.
They're, They're Greco-files, I should say.
They wore the short togas.
and cut their hair up around the ears.
Right, exactly.
Well, Hebrew men cut their hair and their beard once a year, I think.
Okay,
as the tradition.
They must look pretty scraggly.
Right, but Greek and Roman men kept their hair short.
Yeah.
It's in all the statues. You could see it's fairly much the same paradigm we use today. Women had long hair and men had short hair.
Yeah.
In the Greco-Roman world.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, Paul disputing with the Hellenists and that they endeavored to kill him surely indicates that Paul prevailed in his disputes.
Yes.
And that the Hellenists had really no other recourse,
mm-hmm.
which is what, you know, it's what liberals like to do today.
Well,
that
yeah.
They like to kill the people they can't defeat in intellectual argument.
Exactly.
And Paul, it shows that, you know, Paul was educated far beyond the other apostles.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a classical, he was raised at the feet of Gamaliel. There's no doubt that he had a good Hebrew education.
Yes.
But being from Tarsus, he also had an excellent, and it shows in all of his epistles.
Right.
He had an excellent background in Greco-Roman learning.
Yeah, he's a master of rhetoric. Yes, he
absolutely.
Was.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows that he was much more able to deal with these people than the apostles who only knew perhaps the Old Testament scriptures and weren't
right.
cosmopolitan or worldly in their knowledge.
Right, and this is more than likely why Yahshua chose him. Because
he
could articulate what was going on here far better than any of the other apostles could.
Right, Paul had the ideal education to bring the gospel to the dispersion.
That's right.
He could talk to the Greeks about their own myths and traditions and poetry and prove to them what was true and who they were, and that's what he did in his epistles.
That's right. That's right. He proved to them that they were Israelites, and if they weren't exactly Israelites, as in the case of some of the Romans?
Well, the Ionians.
Yes.
I mean, Acts chapter 17. We'll get there. I can't wait to get there.
Okay, very good. All right, so verse 30. Which, when the brethren knew, they brought him down to Caesarea and sent him forth to Tarsus. Then had the churches rest throughout all Judea and Galilee and Samaria and were edified, and walking in the fear of Yahweh and in the comfort of the Holy Ghost were multiplied. So the Christian community was growing. Praise
right.
Yahweh, and Paul had a lot to do with it, right?
Absolutely. And let me say that Paul's going to Tarsus shows that he still has some kind sort of familial connections in Tarsus.
Right.
That he went there for safety.
Yes.
While it can't be demonstrated, I would bet that Paul was probably in Tarsus during most of the time of Yahshua's ministry.
Okay, yes.
And for that reason, he wasn't at all familiar with him and his teachings.
Right, right. Yes, very good. And it came to pass, as Peter passed throughout all quarters, he came down also to the saints which dwelled at Lydda. And there he found a certain man named Aeneas, which had kept his bed 8 years and was sick of the palsy. So he was sick in bed for 8 years, okay? And Peter said to him, Aeneas, Jesus Christ make you whole, arise and make your bed. And he arose immediately. And all that dwelled at Lydda and Saron saw him and turned to Yahweh. Now there was at Joppa a certain disciple.
Well, let me talk about Aeneas for a minute.
Okay.
First, we see it's evident that Peter has the same powers of healing that Christ had.
Yes.
Which
yeah,
was promised to the apostles.
Had it. Yes.
It was promised to the apostles.
Yes.
Now, but I'd like to say a word about Aeneas.
Okay.
Which is the name here. It's Aeneas.
All right.
In the Greek. And you know, Peter would not yet take the word and the gifts of Yahweh to non-Judeans.
Uh-huh.
Now,
right.
We haven't come to the episode we're about to, but we haven't been to the episode with Cornelius yet.
Right.
And Peter's vision. Now, Aeneas is another name it's the same name as the Trojan Prince Aeneas. It's a name from Greco-Roman culture.
Okay.
It's the name of the figure of the Aeneid, the famous poem by Virgil.
Yeah, right.
And I just wanted to point out that he's a Hebrew man with a Greco-Roman name,
right.
or a Trojan name in this case, actually.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, because the Hebrew/Judahite society was being Hellenized because of the Greek.
Well, right, but my point is that, you know, a lot of the Jews like to say that the New Testament was written in Hebrew, which is a lie,
mm-hmm.
and they try to show that the people in Palestine more or less lived in a vacuum.
Yeah, okay.
But by pointing out all these elements of Greco-Roman civilization amongst the Hebrews of the New Testament, it proves just the opposite. That the Hebrews in Palestine at the time of Christ certainly did not live in a vacuum.
Yes,
they
were all
over well the interwoven with Greco-Roman culture.
Well, this is a direct result of the failure to acknowledge the historical dispersion of the 10 and actually the 12 tribes of Israel from the period of 745 B.C. to 701 B.C.
Well, absolutely, and I just like to point out whenever I can, because it occurs so often in the New Testament, that these people had even, you know, they distinguished the Hellenists, but even the non-Hellenists had adopted a great deal of Greco-Roman culture.
Right, right, yes, okay. But even that culture was primarily Israelite.
Yes, it was certainly Israelite culture.
Yes, okay, very good. Verse 36. Now there was at Joppa a certain disciple named Tabitha, which by interpretation is called Dorcas, whatever that means.
Well, that shows again that this book was written in Greek.
Okay.
Because we wouldn't have to interpret this into Hebrew.
Yes.
Dorcas is a Hebrew. I'm sorry. We wouldn't have to interpret the name Tabitha, which is an Aramaic name.
Yes.
In Greek, Dorcas means gazelle.
Okay. All right.
Oh, okay, but I mean, if this wasn't written in Greek, there'd be no reason to interpret that name if this was just being translated from Aramaic.
Right. Okay, very good. This woman was full of good works and alms deeds which she did, which, of course, now she's being praised for doing good works, folks. Remember this. Verse 37, and it came to pass in those days that she was sick and died, whom when they had washed, laid her in an upper chamber. And for as much as Lydda was near to Joppa, and the disciples had heard that Peter was there, they sent him two men, desiring him that he would not delay to come to them. Then Peter arose and went with them. When he was come, they brought him into the upper chamber, and all the widows stood by him weeping, and showing the coats and garments which Dorcas made while she was with them. But Peter put them all forth, and kneeled down and prayed, and turning himself to the body, said, Tabitha, arise. And she opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up.
And there we go. We have a female Lazarus. We have Peter doing everything that Yahshua was able to do.
Yeah, he raised the dead. Okay? That's faith. Remember we were saying last night that even though Peter was, headstrong, he had tremendous faith.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. And your faith can make up for that, folks. All right?
And oddly, not too many, pastors discuss the resurrection of Tabitha.
Okay, yeah.
I hardly ever hear it mentioned.
No. To be frank, Bill, this book of Acts, I don't think I've ever heard a sermon on the book of Acts coming from a mainstream preacher. I don't think I've ever heard one. Okay? It's very rare. Very rare indeed. Okay? And so verse 41, and he gave her his hand and lifted her up, and when he had called the saints and widows, presented her alive. And it was known throughout all Joppa, and many believed in the Lord. And it came to pass that he tarried many days in Joppa with one Simon, a tanner. Okay? Yeah, so reading the book of Acts, you get a much better picture of the society of the Judahites, of the dispersed Israelites, and the people who were actually becoming Christians in these times, okay? So the book of Acts is very historical. It gives us great insight onto what people were like in these days, okay?
Absolutely. I have a quick side note on Joppa, too. I mean, it's not important to the story at all, but
all right.
Joppa is traditionally the city where, in all the Greek myths, Heracles freed Andromeda from the sea monster.
Okay.
And Josephus the historian wrote that you could still see the chains by the seashore.
Okay.
Okay, in his time he wrote that.
All right. All right.
He wrote that in like 90 A.D. maybe.
Okay. All right. Well, there may have, because look at it this way. Remember, there were giants in those days. Okay. And it could be a relic from the days of giants. Maybe somebody had chained up some kind of giant, and the giant got away. Who knows?
Right, but those stories persisted, in the Greek myths for ages.
Right.
And Heracles was a great figure in the Greek myths.
Right.
And what's he doing in Joppa?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's, and that shows that there is certainly, and it's in many places, ancient connection, where the ancient Israelite culture and the Greek culture were basically, I wouldn't say conjoined at the hip, but they were interwoven in many areas.
Right.
They were the same culture.
Well, wouldn't the story of Heracles be based on the story of Samson?
I don't think so.
No?
I don't think so. I mean, a lot of the myths, the individual tales that are that we see the feats that Samson described in the Bible,
uh-huh,
the Greeks may have taken some of those individual tales,
yes,
and described them to Heracles.
Okay.
But
okay,
the word Heracles is very interesting.
Okay.
Because the word Rakal in Hebrew means a traitor.
Okay.
And Ha Rakalim would mean the traitors.
Okay.
So I think that the word Heracles is actually a memory of the Phoenician merchants,
uh-huh,
who settled the great parts of Greece and the rest of the Mediterranean.
They settled virtually the entire Mediterranean basin. Yeah.
And that's, I think that the word Heracles actually, you know, started,
okay,
from myths about the Phoenicians of old.
Okay, so it could actually be a reference to the Phoenicians. Very good. Okay, excellent. Okay. Well, let's get into chapter 10. And there was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of the band called Italian Band. Okay? Anything here? Because obviously he's from Italy.
Well, yes. The Romans, it was very typical to form cohorts and entire legions, by
yes,
the way, from men of a particular region.
Yes.
And not to keep them in the army in their own legion.
Okay.
Region, never.
Yes.
They would never keep a British cohort that they formed in Britain.
Uh-huh.
They would bring them to Germany and have them do service in Germany.
Right, that's what the New World Order is doing today.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's what they do, because then your army has no allegiance to the common people in the area.
Uh-huh.
Okay,
yes.
And actually would slaughter them gleefully in many cases.
Yes.
And that's even true, you know,
right.
I mean, bring Germans to England and England to German, to
right,
Germany, and that's what you end up with.
That's, yeah,
and,
that's
and,
how you keep order, because you don't expect indigenous troops to kill their own people.
Exactly.
Yes.
And they're glad to kill foreigners.
That's right.
Even when they're of the same race.
Right.
And the Romans had the model down to a science, and the New World Order practices it today.
Yes, they're copying that, absolutely. Okay, verse 2. Now, this Cornelius was a devout man, and one that feared God with all his house, which gave much alms to the people and prayed to God always. So he was actually a good Israelite, right? Isn't that what we're being told here?
Absolutely. First, I'd like to say real quick in reference to the band called Italian.
Okay.
Josephus, in his description of Herod's funeral in Antiquities,
okay,
lists cohorts or bands of Thracians, Germans, and Galatians in,
uh-huh,
attendance,
okay,
at Herod's funeral.
Right.
But Cornelius certainly fits the description of lost Israel given in Isaiah chapter 56.
Okay.
That explains that the dispersed Israelites, because that's who Isaiah chapter 56 is talking about,
uh-huh,
who continue to follow, to seek Yahweh and to follow his way,
yes,
and to keep the law, even if they don't consciously know they're keeping the law.
Right, right.
And,
yeah,
and you know, to keep the Sabbath and live a godly life.
Yeah. And they weren't living in Judea either.
Their name would be magnified even above that of sons and daughters,
okay,
meaning the rest of Israel.
Right.
So Cornelius seems to fulfill that promise of Isaiah 56.
Yes. Okay, very good. All right, verse 3. And he saw in a vision, evidently about the ninth hour of the day, an angel of God coming into him and saying to him, Cornelius. And when he looked on him, he was afraid and said, What is it, Lord? And he said to him, Your prayers and your alms are come up for a memorial before God. And now send men to Joppa and call for one Simon whose surname is Peter. Okay? So in this, he's being given a vision by the angel that he should get in touch with Simon Peter. Okay? Verse 6. He lodges with one Simon, a tanner, which we met earlier at the end of chapter 9.
Yes.
Yes. Whose house is by the seaside. He shall tell you what you ought to do. And when the angel which spoke to Cornelius was departed, he called two of his household servants and a devout soldier of them that waited on him continually. And when he had declared all these things to them, he sent them to Joppa. On the morrow, as they went on their journey and drew near the city, Peter went up upon the housetop to pray about the sixth hour. Okay, so this is the next day, sixth hour. The first vision was the ninth hour of the previous
day. And the sixth hour would be about noon.
Right.
And okay. The ninth hour would be about 3 p.m.
Okay, so.
Because the Greeks counted, they divided the days into hours and the nights into watches.
Yes.
And the day, the first hour of the day began at sunrise.
Right, right. So the 3 p.m. the previous day and noon the following day are the times we're talking about here, verse 10. And he became very hungry and would have eaten, but while they made ready, he fell into a trance. Okay, so folks, this is a trance, and we have to understand that this is a trance and not a literal literal experience here.
And he didn't smoke a joint.
Yeah, right. Verse 11. And he saw heaven open, kind of like John, okay, in the Revelation.
Absolutely.
And a certain vessel descending to him, as it had been a great sheet, knit at the four corners and let down to earth. So this, carpet, flying carpet, came descending down from heaven. Verse 12, wherein were all manner of four-footed beasts of the earth and wild beasts and creeping things and fowls of the air. And there came a voice to him saying, rise, Peter, kill and eat. But Peter said, not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean. Now
we have to stop right here.
Okay.
This fully indicates that Peter still kept the food laws.
Yes.
After the crucifixion.
Yes.
Okay, because he still had the conception that certain animals could be common or unclean.
Right.
And the word... The word common should be translated profane.
Okay.
And nobody, I mean, I've never seen any other, even identity pastor, make the distinction between what's common and what's unclean.
Yeah, well, it mentions both, so there should be a distinction, right?
Right, and unclean means that we're not supposed to eat it according to the law. It's deemed unclean by Yahweh.
Okay.
And the common or profane means that it was food that would not be prepared in accordance with the Hebrew strictures in the Old Testament or in the tradition of the elders.
Uh-huh.
In other words, they had all kinds of rules that their food had to be washed
in
a certain manner.
Okay.
And it had to be prepared in a certain manner.
Right.
And they were very legalistic, the Pharisees, in the preparation of food.
Okay, all right. So Peter was very scrupulous about observing both. Okay.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. Well, you know, whatever the Pharisees and the scribes sit in Moses' seat, and whatever they say, you do.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, all the people of Judea were following all these little legalistic laws, these crazy rules that the Pharisees had.
Right. Yeah, so they made the Levitical priests look tame by comparison in terms of ritual.
Well, absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, they carried it way off the map. I mean,
yes.
They went to extremes.
Yes. Okay, verse 15. And the voice spoke to him again a second time, what God has cleansed, that call not you common. Of course, this verse is deemed by the Paul worshipers to mean that now you can eat anything you choose.
Well, right, and it doesn't mean that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because what has Yahweh cleansed?
Yes.
What was cleansed on the cross?
Yes.
To understand what Yahweh has cleansed, we have to turn to the Old Testament prophecy.
Right.
And what Yahweh said he would clean or cleanse.
Now, Bill, are you suggesting that this verse has a historical meaning?
Well, absolutely. Because, you know, I could give a whole list of verses.
Yes.
And Paul shows it in Hebrews 13:12 that the Old Testament prophets state explicitly that it's the children of Israel who would be cleansed by Yahweh and nobody else.
So
Isaiah 1:2, Isaiah 1:18,
okay.
Jeremiah 13:27, Jeremiah 33:7-8.
Yes.
It's in Ezekiel, it's in Joel. It's only the children of Israel and their cleansing that was a matter of prophecy.
Okay.
It wasn't for anybody else.
Right. So this is not literally referring to these unclean animals on this flying carpet.
No, it's referring to the Roman pigs and the Greek pigs.
Yes.
Because the ancient Hebrews considered them pigs.
Yes.
Because basically you are what you eat.
You're right.
You know, and if you're going to eat dog and pig, mm-hmm. I'm not going to associate with you.
Right.
The Greeks were, you know, a lot of the Greeks were particular about what they ate.
Okay.
But the Romans ate everything. The Romans were the Chinese of the ancient world.
Okay. Right.
Okay. I mean, there are actually Epicurean mosaics and paintings found in Pompeii and other places in archaeology in Italy.
Yeah.
And with all the depictions of the food that they ate.
Okay.
And it's just like the Italians of today. They eat basically anything that moves.
Right.
You know,
and
I'm sorry, Fausto.
Roadkill, too.
Yeah, calamari and scungeal and, well, conch and squid and
right.
and
well,
clams and mollusk and everything
right.
that could move, they eat.
Well, if it was run over by a Lamborghini, it must be good.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so verse 16. This was done thrice, and the vessel was received up again into heaven. Okay, so this vision with the command, what God has cleansed, that not call you common. So this was impressed upon his mind three times, okay? So he doesn't forget. Verse 17.
And the children of Israel had become common and unclean
okay.
when Yahweh divorced them.
Right.
And
right.
the Greeks, and Peter doesn't really know it.
Right.
But Paul certainly knows it.
Yes.
That the Romans and most of the Greeks are dispersed Israelites.
That's right. That's right. Of course, Peter does not know this, and Paul does. Yes, he does. Okay, now verse 17. Now while Peter doubted in himself what this vision which had been seen should mean, behold, the men which were sent from Cornelius had made inquiry for Simon's house and stood before the gate. So there's a connection between these two visions.
Right. Okay. And first, Peter needed the vision three times again.
Yes.
That has to be noted.
Yes.
He had to see it three times.
Right.
And the vision got to Peter at precisely the right time.
Exactly.
Exactly when he needed it.
So
doesn't have a very long attention span.
Yeah. So he opens his eyes, and lo and behold, these guys are standing at the door. Okay. Oh, maybe the Lord's trying to tell me something. Okay. And he called and asked whether Simon, which was surnamed Peter, were lodged there. While Peter thought on the vision, the Spirit said to him, behold, three men seek you. There's three again. Arise, therefore, and get you down and go with them, doubting nothing, for I have sent them. All right. So this is what the angel was telling him. So he better pay attention. Verse 21. Then Peter went down to the men which were sent to him from Cornelius and said, behold, I am he whom you seek. What is the cause why you are come? And they said, Cornelius, the centurion, a just man and one that fears God and of good report among all the nation of the Judeans, was warned from God by a holy angel to send for you into his house and to hear words of you. Okay, so this is obviously of Yahweh here, verse 23. Then called he them in and lodged them. And
now, let me say that if it weren't for the vision, Peter would never have admitted these men into the house.
That's quite right. Yes, quite right. And then, because, yeah, he being a Judean, would not associate with non-Judeans. It was forbidden.
Absolutely.
It was forbidden. Okay. Then called he them in and lodged them. And on the morrow, Peter went away with them, and a certain brethren from Joppa accompanied him. And the morrow after, they entered into Caesarea. And Cornelius waited for them and had called together his kinsmen and near friends. So here is Peter, a Judean, now associating with these non-Judeans. Okay? And as Peter was coming in, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter took him up, saying, stand up, I myself also am a man. All right, do you think by this statement in verse 26, Peter is acknowledging that Cornelius is also a man?
Well, of course.
Okay.
And you know, the last thing the apostles wanted to do was to be worshipped. And the last thing that
right.
true messengers of God want to do is to be worshipped.
Right, right.
You know, the angel kept telling John, what are you doing? Get up. I'm just, you know, a guy talking to you, baby.
Right. But what
in the Revelation.
Yeah, but what I'm driving at is, do you think Peter here acknowledges Cornelius as an Adamite / Judahite / Judean at this point?
Well, right. He's basically humbling himself
right.
by saying he's a mere man.
Right.
But he's also, you know, he has to recognize Cornelius as a peer.
Okay. He is recognizing him as a peer. Very good. Verse 27, and as he talked with him, he went in and found many that were come together. Now, folks, here's verse 28, which all of these you-can-eat-anything people totally ignore. And he said to them, you know how that it is an unlawful thing for a man that is a Judean to keep company or come to one of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any man uncommon or unclean.
Right, and Peter's not really taking that, you know, what Yahweh has cleansed in the biblical perspective yet.
No.
Or he's only limiting the definition of man to Adamites, which is a certainty in the Greco-Roman world anyway.
Right. But he's obviously acknowledged here in verse 28 that he understands that division is not literally about food.
Oh, it's definitely not about food.
Yeah. How can
anybody that thinks that Acts chapter 10 is about a ham sandwich is just an idiot.
Yeah.
And it's true that they do think that.
Yeah.
But that's just idiotic.
Well, they obviously don't read verse 28, which explains everything that happens previously.
Well, like you said, they're verse snatchers.
they
snatch one verse and make a story up about it.
It's incredible. They can take verses out of context, claim that they're about making any kind of food edible for Christians/Israelites, and then they never discuss verse 28, which proves that they're wrong.
Absolutely.
It's hypocrisy. Verse 29,
it blatantly shows that they don't take anything in context.
Right, yeah. Well, like when Nico and Brian were talking about the glossolalia people, they reversed the logic of those verses as well, you know, because...
Right, but they reverse the logic of a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know, they take the promise to Abraham that his offspring would become many nations,
yes.
And they make it say that his many nations would become his offspring.
Right.
They read they're all dyslexic.
Yeah, right. So, that's mystical, I suppose. Because I don't see how many nations could come and become his offspring if they weren't directly descended from him, right?
Well, right, but I mean that, yeah, they wave a magic wand and poof,
yes.
Just like the Jews
right.
believe that, you know, you dunk a person in the water, and when you pull him up, he's an Israelite,
yeah,
you know?
And John said that Yahweh could make Israelites out of stones, right, didn't he?
Right? Well, right, but the truth of the matter is that doesn't mean that they're heirs of the covenant.
Right, yeah, or that he ever did such a thing either. And as
Absolutely.
Far as I know, he never did. Not that he couldn't, but he never did. Okay? Verse 29. Therefore came I to you without gainsaying, as soon as I was sent for. I asked, therefore, for what intent you have sent me. And Cornelius said, 4 days ago I was fasting until this hour. And at the ninth hour I prayed in my house, and behold, a man stood before me in bright clothing. And Cornelius, your prayer is heard, and your alms are had in remembrance in the sight of God. Send therefore to Joppa and call here Simon, whose surname is Peter. He is lodged in the house of one Simon, a tanner by the seaside, who, when he comes, shall speak to you. Immediately therefore I sent to you, and you have well done that you are come. Now therefore are we all here present before God to hear all things that are commanded you of God. Now, verse 33. This is after the crucifixion.
Well, let's just say first that it's after the crucifixion that these things are commanded, and that Peter and Cornelius had concurrent visions just like Ananias and Paul had.
Right. So, excuse me, the sneeze. Oh, okay, so now we're being commanded of Yahweh to do certain things, and yet the antinomians tell us the law has been abolished. Now, there's no commandments. We don't have to worry about any commandments. But we have numerous instances that we found in Acts, numerous instances that this is not the case, that commandments are still being issued after the crucifixion. Verse 34, then Peter opened his mouth and said, of a truth, I perceive that God is no respecter of persons. And I know you want to discuss that.
Well, okay, no respecters of persons. You know, a lot of mainstream Christians like to try to make that a racial statement.
Right.
And it's not a racial statement at all.
Yes.
It's a, I translate it everywhere, a respecter of the stature of person.
Right.
Or the status of a person.
Status, yes.
And that is because it's defined that way in James chapter 2.
Okay.
Reading James chapter 2, the same word is used to compare the wealthy and the poor.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with race. It has to do only with your station in life.
Right.
And a religion and the practices, I mean, Peter had already accepted men, and that's evident in Acts chapter 2.
Yes.
And in Acts chapter 7, that had been converted to Judaism and circumcised.
Right. Right.
So it's clear that Peter is using it even in this manner.
Yes.
Of the status of persons.
Yes.
And that's
exactly
what the word means.
Yes.
That's what it meant in secular Greek. That it's used that way in Isaiah,
right,
in the Septuagint. And
right,
it's the James chapter 2 is the